Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is Tom Hartman,
where smart people get their news.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. And increasingly, the European way. It's Tom Hartman broadcasting today, well, all this week, live from Copenhagen, Denmark. Just a quick note here, the 94, that's not the year, that's the number, the 94 Democrats in the House of Representatives who supported the FISA legislation received an average of $18,359 more than did those who voted against it from Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint, according to MapLight, a nonpartisan group that tracks campaign contributions and legislation. Sold out. I was going to say for a few pieces of silver, I guess. That's the phrase that's being applied to poor Scotty, but Scott McClellan, our guest yesterday. Right now on the line with us is Tyler Brulé. He is the editor and also the editor-in-chief and also the chairman of Monocle, an international magazine published out of London. Tyler Brulé is a Canadian, and he's talking to us today from where are you, sir?
I'm about to cross the border from Italy into Switzerland right now.
On your cell phone. And great to have you with us. You, as a designer, you were hired by Swiss International Airlines to redesign their airline for their relaunch in 2001. You were the youngest recipient ever of the British Society of Magazine Editors Lifetime Achievement Award. You hosted a TV magazine show called The Desk on BBC4 in 2005. And now you're publishing this magazine, Monocle. And in it, you have the top 25 cities in the world, and the city where I live, Portland, Oregon, is number 25, and number one was Copenhagen, Denmark.
Absolutely. It's the second time we've done this. Monocle's about 18 months old as a magazine, Tom, and we wanted to apply a new set of metrics to really measure livability and to try to, I think, set cities apart slightly from the other lists that float around in the world. And after about a good solid year of research, we started immediately after we did ours last year. Copenhagen came in not quite as high last year. Our number one city last year was Munich, but Copenhagen got the top position when we announced it last week.
So I guess the big question is, what makes for a livable city? What are the metrics that you're using in deciding this? And as a stepping off point from that, as civil societies, as Democrats, small d democratic societies, what should we, the people, be pushing for more of and less of, frankly, in order to make our urban spaces more hospitable to human life?
Well, when we talk about metrics to start, I think that it was quite diverse. We obviously looked at the basics, which, of course, are crime, education, infrastructure, of course, elements like public transport, for example. But then we also try to feature and focus on softer items as well. How easy is it to get a drink at 3 o'clock in the morning? How many cinema screens are within a city center? And I say within city center because, going to the second part of your question, what should people be pushing for? It's very interesting when we actually talk to readers and we looked at the metrics that people really focus on time and again. It's not about having a long driveway with three cars in it, and having a nice fence. People want to be able to walk and get their milk. They want to be able to walk and get their newspapers. They want to live in a neighborhood which is not just populated by big brands, but they want to be in a community which supports small businesses and protects small businesses. And so when we looked at and added all of these things up, Copenhagen was really the city which came out on top for those reasons. On the other side as well, of course, global connectivity was incredibly important too, that a city should be also well linked to the rest of the world, which of course kicks a number of cities out of the list.
Right. So, in fact, this is one of the very interesting things that we're seeing, and I know Portland is very big on this, you know, working in this direction to create what are sometimes referred to as multi-use zones, and there are other terms to describe them. Places in the city where, you know, the downstairs of the building is, for example, small retail space. The upstairs is residential space. The park is across the street. There's such a wide variety of different types of retail stores that you can pretty much get whatever you need whenever you need it. There's restaurants. There's bars. There's public transportation nearby. That's the sort of standard is the wrong word. Goal, I guess.
I think that's a large part of it, and it's interesting that you're in Copenhagen, because when we looked at Copenhagen last year, an element of the World Health Organization sits in Copenhagen, and it is it's the area that looks at public health, and particularly public with regard to the community. And what they found, and they called us after a survey last year, they said there is a direct relationship between vibrant communities and people's happiness, and I think, as we know, if people are generally happy, they tend to be quite healthy. And I think when we look at what I think, you know, voters and some of the community should be pushing from their leadership, it's just that. It is that sense of, you know, if you have a vibrant, strong community, and certainly one thing that the WHO found, the World Health Organization, is small businesses, where you've got, you know, families invested in running businesses, there's a good chance that you're going to be recognized when you go in and buy your bread in the morning, or you go pick up your dry cleaning, or whatever it may be. And when you're recognized, recognition makes you happy. And it's quite interesting that they're actually trying to push this as a component of public health.
Yeah, well, and there's a flip side to that too, and that is if you recognize the vendor, then that vendor is more likely to treat you fairly, make sure that the vegetables are actually good and not spoiled or contaminated with DDT or whatever. And whereas if it's just you're dealing with an anonymous corporation whose CEO is 22 states away on the other side of the continent, there's a whole different gestalt there.
Absolutely. And it's one of the reasons why cities like London did not make our list. London is really, we call it the high streetification of the UK, that all high streets, all local streets are increasingly populated by the same coffee company with the green logo and the two other national competitors that exist in the UK, perhaps just one of two grocery stores, and small businesses disappearing. And I think people are scratching their heads saying, well, but why is crime rising? Why is there more petty crime on the street? Because you've got quite a loose community at that point.
Right, and people don't feel as invested in it. It seems that the 1950s ideal, at least in the United States, of a house in the suburbs, you know, with the you said the three cars in the driveway, just even one car in the driveway, is increasingly all around the... we have lost Tyler Brulé. Okay. Well, we'll take a break here at this point and move along with the show. And I want to get back into some of the news of the day too when we come back from the break. But we're gonna pick up a break right now and continue the conversation. Broadly speaking, you know, get the point of view of Danes in Denmark and what's going on. We'll take your calls, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll free nationwide, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, HartmannRadio.com. You can check all that out. And, of course, Monocle.com was the website for Tyler Brulé's magazine, Monocle. 14 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartmann Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann.
Land. This is our country.
Broadcasting live from the East Coast to the West Coast, from the northern border to the southern, the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio. And in the studio with me, I'm very pleased to have one of the guys who helped facilitate all this, help make it possible for us to be doing this show, Jesper Grunwald.
Yes, that's a German name, yeah. In Denmark.
Yeah, and Jesper has a background as a journalist, and you're a manager here with Danish National Radio.
Yes, I am.
And you run a couple of the channels, and a very knowledgeable observer of the Danish scene, and like this. You're available to us for the hour, so I'd like to just give a shout out to our listeners. If you have a question you'd like to ask a very knowledgeable observer of this country, and also you've spent a fair amount of time in the United States. You've been there a number of times. Mm. In fact, you were in Toronto, I guess, on 9/11, and
yeah.
You were in the U.S. during Operation Desert Storm. So a good observer. So if you have questions about all of these issues that we've been discussing all this week. And the things that we're going to be talking about, our number 866-303-2270. Jesper is going to be with us this hour. And Jesper, we were talking a little earlier about some of the paradoxes of Danish society, and yet even within the paradoxes, there's kind of a non-paradox in as much as you have here what you call the right and the left, but neither one of them would say that there shouldn't be a national health care service, that college education shouldn't be free, that there shouldn't be discounted daycare, things like this.
I could say that an example is the most right-wing party, the Danish Folks Party, which was created out of the discussion about immigration in Denmark, and who had a part of the discussions about the Muhammad drawings and so on.
Yeah, we're going to have that.
It will be regarded as a rather right-wing party. I'm not sure they consider it so themselves, but in the social context, mm-hmm. it's in effect of you might call it a right-wing social democrat party because it's the left wing of the government.
Hmm.
So the paradox, there are a lot of paradoxes in this country. The problem or the reality is that when you live as a part of it, you don't see all the different. You may consider this country being much more divided as it is. Mm. So when I now and then go abroad to the United States, which is a country I admire very much, not all, but the country and its people, I sometimes is got this confrontation. I don't forget then I was at a big radio NAB convention,
mm-hmm.
radio in
National
in,
Association
yes, exactly in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
crazy town, mm-hmm. crazy city.
It is.
City, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was driving with a cab driver. I'm always talking to the cab drivers. That's mm-hmm. a good point of view to recognize the country. I mean, if you want to meet the immigrants in Denmark, talk to a cab driver because mm-hmm. no Danes are driving cabs. And I met a new kind of cab drivers in Las Vegas. It was people retiring. And they liked, as they told me, to go to Vegas because the housing was cheaper than in mm-hmm. California. I met people from Hawaii and so on. And then I met another. He was kind enough, but he was a little angry. Okay, you're a friend. And it was during the Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
And to a European person, your country seemed very nationalistic in that country with all the mm-hmm. flags and don't forget our soldiers. And I know it has its own conditions and reasons, but he was he found out that I was European and asked where I was coming from. I was coming from Denmark. He has been working for IBM in London and Europe, and he said, "Okay, this is a socialist country,
Denmark."
Yeah, he considered our country to be a socialist country,
right.
And
but the Danes don't consider themselves socialists.
No, not at all. And I even heard. If it is a bad thing to be a socialist country, you can choose it yourself. But I met it even during our present so-called liberal government, which in European country means conservative
right.
government, to the same declaration about it. And I think the paradox is that even if we have this contradictions in the society. And we have this classical European division between labor parties, democratic socialist parties mm-hmm. of the left side,
right.
and liberal from a European point of view, it means conservative, Christian, all those called Christian parties.
Right. And they're and they tend to be more the pro-business parties as well.
Yes, exactly. Liberal in our context is non-socially. It means more money from people's private money in their own pockets, and that old classical story. It's a typical European British way of looking at it. Yeah. In spite of this left and right and big, not riots, but discussions about when it comes to the bottom line, the best example is our present Prime Minister, Mr. Fogh Rasmussen, which has been taking a lot to do with, about the war in...
This is the guy who's good buddies with George Bush, who has, who has committed Danish soldiers to Afghanistan and Iraq. In fact, your losses in Afghanistan and Iraq on a per capita basis have been among the highest in the world. And
it's true.
And yet this guy is totally in favor of your social welfare state.
Yes, he changed. He seemed to change his mind. I mean,
really?
When he was a young academic coming from an agriculture surrounding, living in the countryside, going to the city, it's a part of culture in itself.
Yeah.
He took a higher education, and he wrote a book, not famous, but well-known book called The Minimal State. The Minimum State.
Uh-huh.
You can...
Sure.
Okay. It means
this is the Grover Norquist
how to build up a society much more like yours.
Right.
A bigger private sector... more privatizing and so on. But the lobbyist told him, and after some years, if you really want to be the Prime Minister of Denmark, you need to work for the consensus line. You need, because most of the Danes, even conservative people, has it in that way, that having a social security, having official not paid hospitals and schools, that's a necessity.
Right. So it's this is just an absolute baseline that's not going to go away. It's been here since the 1920s, and it's not changing. In many of the former Soviet states, like in Hungary and Albania and what, they're having these huge debates right now about which way they're going to go. Are they going to end up more like Denmark, or are they going to end up more like the United States is? Any sense of the direction of Europe?
I never forget 1989, where they broke down the wall, because one of my, part of my family, my grandfather was a German, so I really, in effect, had family and traveled as a journalist and a private person in the former so-called German Democratic Republic.
Right.
1989, I was in London seeing them breaking down. I didn't predict, and I couldn't, I simply saw, I thought that this situation would mean that they would have a soft change from communism, socialism into liberalism. But reality was that they changed much faster.
Faster. 29 minutes faster.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman here with you. And Jesper Grunwald is with us, world famous reporter. And Danish radio, about 75% of the total market share here is state run, essentially, like our equivalent of NPR.
Two big companies tried to hit us. The last one was the biggest. Commercial Danish-owned, state-owned, but it is on sale. Television state. But the first one was Sky, who tried to hit us.
Oh yeah, out of
Murdoch and very big business. After 2 years, they fell out of the market.
Oh, interesting. So you guys even bumped Murdoch out.
Yeah.
Let's take some phone calls here, Jesper. Yeah. Eric in Beaver, Pennsylvania, and Jesper is J-E-S-P-E-R. That would in English. It would be pronounced Jesper. Eric, you're on the air with Jesper.
Yes, I'd like to thank your guest for availing his time to us. And my question I hadn't heard answered during any of the guests was, how much of the Danish economy goes towards their military, their defense? He answered the second part of my question, which was about the welfare programs, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Eric. It's a good question. And also, you have conscription here. You have a draft.
Yeah, we have. So, even is it a, but it's the exact amount, how much is used for the military, to be honest, I don't know. We should fix it in one day.
Yeah. We'll find out.
Yeah, we might find out. Yeah. But I can say that the structure of the military has been changing for the last year from defending the little fairy tale country north of Europe or south of Scandinavia or in the middle.
You're right. Yeah.
That's our role. To be occupied in conflicts over the world. We have often, even my own father was a soldier, UN soldier in Palestine, Gaza. We have been in the UN troops for many years, but especially during the Afghan war and of the Iraq war, we have been in the Iraq war. In effect, we are in war for the first time since 1864.
Which is when the modern constitutional...
The constitution is 48 in Denmark, but in 64 we were hit by, and it is, it, we lost five, we lost 20% of our country. No, one third of our country at the time. Germany took a big bite of Denmark, and we got it back in 1920. That's history about Denmark. Yeah. But our troops are now much more trained for international working.
Right. And with regard to the draft here, if you don't want to go into military service, you can work in a hospital or something. You can do a nonprofit at a very low pay. But not everybody is hit by the draft. It's a lottery like we had at the end of Vietnam.
A minor part is hit by the draft.
So only it's fascinating. Let's see. George in South Dakota. You're on the air with Jesper Grunwald.
Hi. Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I'm very well, George. Thank you.
Good, good. Hey, I just wanted to give you my take on why I think the Danes are so happy, and I would love to be a Dane. You know, I've seen some interviews on some media shows about from Danes about their you know, why they are content. I think because Americans have such high expectations, because it's such a driven society, we are setting ourselves up constantly to be failing. And with higher education being such a major expense and such a burden, after graduation, and the Danes, on the other hand, have, full child care from, you know, from birth, basically, pre-K, all their education up through graduate school paid for by the government, who wouldn't be happy?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty simple and straightforward. And, George, in fact, in the next hour we're going to have on the fellow who wrote the study that was in the British Medical Journal about happiness. Your thoughts, Jesper, on Danes and happiness?
Sometimes when I'm talking about my own country, I'm listening to myself, so to say. I feel that I'm telling a story which is much more happy than the truth. A genuine Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale.
A Dane.
I mean, we are no village. We are not a suburban of Europe. We are a country and we have our own troubles. But from my personal point of view, the happiness is placed in this consensus culture. It's controversial because the consequences of being very alike in the political point of views are that sometimes Danes are missing the differences. I tell you, when I cross California on a Harley Davidson, as I have done for some times, feeling the freedom and the space and doing whatever I want. And I see poor people. It's bad to see that. Poorer people than in my country. I feel a kind of happiness too. So what is very important is not to say we are not better, we are not more happy, but we have a system that suits the population as it is for the time being. And I think that most of the people will like a system where education are paid even on a higher level,
right,
in spite of the consequence, which is that I pay a very big part of my income in taxes.
Right, right. But on the other hand, your payroll is fairly high so that you can take home after the taxes enough to live on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in fact, enough to go to California and have a vacation. As a person who's working for the equivalent of NPR, mm-hmm, and you still have, what, 6 weeks a year paid vacation? And
yeah.
So not bad. 866-303-2270. Michael in Portland, you're on with Jesper Grunwald.
Yeah, good evening, guys. I'm curious, sort of have a two-part question about entrepreneurship. And Tom, you've started many businesses, so you can give us the American side. How hard is it for somebody to leave their job and start a small company, say a computer repair or a microbrewery? And parallel to that, how hard is it if you start to grow and hire employees to lay them off if things start reversing and you can't afford to keep paying them?
Great questions, Michael.
Great question. And it's a if it's not a controversial question, the answer can be controversial, but mm-hmm, it's the paradox again. Mm-hmm. One part of it is that, of course, when you are hiring people in a high-tech society, you need to pay them a good salary to get the best people.
Right.
And that's the classical conservative point of view. The taxes are too high. It's too difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of the coin, as we say in this country, is that the rules of the working rules are very liberal. In effect, people are coming from especially Southern Europe to study it. Mm. Here you employ people, and if there's no more job, you, so to say, fire them. It's very, I know it sounds a little cynical, but it's very dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So it should be rather easy to build it up and close it down if you cannot sell what you have been producing.
Right. So there's not so much risk to an entrepreneur. I remember when I lived in Germany, we started a business there, and if you fired somebody after the first year and a half, you had to pay them, you know, a half a year's salary.
Exactly.
If you fired them after 15 years, you had to pay them like 6 years' salary.
I have a brother-in-law working in big medical business in Europe, all over the world. So, and when they are going to take over a company in France or Germany, Italy.
Mm-hmm. The problem is that they're
you're always having two lawyers and one more outside.
Right. Yeah.
So in Denmark, it's right more
now, easy. The biggest problem we have in the United States that entrepreneurs have, and speaking as Eric said, I've started a number of businesses in the United States, built them up and sold them off, and the challenge now is that in the 1970s, when I first started my first business, every small shopping center was 90% local businesses. Whether it was the clothing store, the dry cleaner, the first business that I started when I was 19 years old. It was across the street from Michigan State University, and I was working part-time in radio, and Louise and I started a TV repair and electronics repair shop. I was an old ham radio operator. And we built that up to 5 employees, which was enough to, you know, I made enough to pay for college. And I don't think that you could do that now in the United States. It would be so hard because now 90% of all the retail space in the United States is big chain corporations. Mm. How is it here in Denmark, and how is it across the rest of Europe with regard to these kinds of things?
In Denmark, I need to say it's the same thing with one big difference.
Mm.
This country is having 5 million people, one-third of bigger New York, one-third of bigger London with suburbans.
Right.
So it is, and we have a country which is not very big. So it is very concentrated, and it's concentrated on high capital selling.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more concentrated than 10 years ago, right. But because of the size of the country, the feeling of it isn't that hard as in your country,
right.
as in the United States.
The publisher of Monocle that we had on, Mr. Brulé, he said that one of the reasons that he chose Copenhagen as the number one most livable city in the world is because there was so much small local business everywhere you went. And that's what Louise and I have seen walking around the city.
That is true.
Is everything seems to... I haven't seen anything that looks like a chain store. I haven't seen a McDonald's yet. I haven't seen a Starbucks. I'm sure they're out there, but I haven't seen them.
No.
So there is... It is an entrepreneurial opportunity here.
I'm quite sure, and I think it's a conservative point of view that it's difficult because of the salary. But the question to the people, or the work and the clever people, the people with skills, is: do you like to work in a country where you pay a high tax, or is reality that if you do not can put all the money in your own pockets, right, you're not interested.
Or would they rather go to Ireland?
That's
where the
interesting.
Taxes are
lower. How pessimistic should I be?
Or you go to Ireland where the taxes are lower, but the salaries are lower also, which is one of the reasons that Ireland has been growing.
Yeah.
45 minutes past the hour. Jesper Grunewald with Danish National Radio with us. We'll be right back with more of your calls.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Steve in Portland, Oregon. You're on the air with Jesper Grunewald.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask, I had seen a program on C-SPAN where a professor from a British university was talking about convening a trial in The Hague for Mr. Bush. And I'm wondering what the European feeling is about that, and I whether we can encourage it, too.
Uh-huh. Okay. Let me rephrase that, if I may, a little bit. And, Steve, the question, Jesper, do you think that George Bush is going to have a General Pinochet moment? Will there be a time when he comes to Europe and he faces an arrest warrant for war crimes?
No, I don't. I think, to be honest, and it's a problem from my point of view, is that... President Bush might have given the impression that we are not able to control the American policy at all or cooperate about it. Can we impress this kind of government? That's my bigger question, because I mean we have been together in NATO for many, many years.
Denmark, the
European culture is a part of the American culture. We love it now and then. We do not love everything. We love it. And we have been during the Korea War, especially the Vietnam War. I'm 54 years, so I don't forget this year where it's very controversial to be a son of a soldier, for example, because of the American War. So no war crimes. I'm not sure, but there is, from my point of view, there is things to be repaired, so to say, because maybe especially in Denmark, because Clinton was so popular. I never forget his visit in Copenhagen. And I never forget the visit of Mr. Bush.
Yeah.
During the visit of, and now I'm not talking about the two persons because I don't know them, but when Clinton visited Copenhagen, it was like a kind of festival, Kennedy-like, so to say. Mm-hmm. Kennedy, John F. never was here.
He was rock star.
In Berlin. Never here, yeah. And when Bush was here, it was a little bit more stark and security, of course, because of the war of Iraq and so on. So there is thing to be repaired, and it is not only a question about right and left wing. Even my father, which is a
European conservative
former soldier, he's talking about Obama. I don't think this consensus in your country.
Yeah.
If you really like America, he has been working there, my father, for 2 years, and he loved this country. Mm-hmm. And he has been a soldier in a coalition with the country.
Right.
He wants a president that can repair the conditions and the liaisons between America.
Right. So
you might call him a conservative.
Fascinating. Dave in Los Angeles, listen on K-Talk. You're on the air with Jesper Grunewald.
Hi, Tom, and thank you for taking the show to over there. This is so great that we get to hear this perspective. But I'd like to ask Jesper a question. I'm going to lead a little bit of a diatribe to get there. This country in the U.S. has been divided over so many issues, polarized on so many issues, what I call digital brains, not to be confused with technology. Either it's one or a zero, either it's on or it's off, it's black or it's white, good or evil. This comes into the economics, I think. Either it's Keynesianism or it's Hayek. Either it's liberal or conservative, supply or demand. It seems to be we're divided on this issue. I think the proper term is somewhere in the middle, the best of both worlds, and it sounds like the Danish are there. Would he agree on that?
That's an excellent question. You have entrepreneurialism. You don't have the government in the private sector. And yet you have this broad definition of the commons, which includes everything from your media to water and power and electric to health care and education.
I agree very much personally. The best of both worlds is a good expression about it.
Yeah.
I mean, the Iron Curtain collapsed. The differences between communism and liberalism, which we have been living with.
Liberalism, I mean, in the European sense.
In European,
let's say communism and conservatism.
The cousin of my father lived in Eastern Germany, and so I had been living with it. It was not a discussion thousands of kilometers away. I was living in this condition, apart from some Americans who are talking about it.
Yeah.
It broke down. I think we need a kind of breaking down, bringing the best of two worlds together. And what I was most sad about when I visited the States a few years ago was something I never met in the States before. One thing is I was at Bear Lake on the Harley in the Southern California, very far, a beautiful place. And then an older man went all over the town square to me and said, "Where are you from?" There were so many people. I said, "I'm from Scandinavia." And he said, "Oh, I hope I live in your country," as if he was a prisoner of his own country. It's a little bit maybe too dramatic, and I was only a tourist. But this feeling of people talking to me like they did it when I visited the eastern part of the Iron Curtain some years earlier, 10 years earlier, I didn't like. This is one thing I didn't like. The other thing I didn't like, it was on a radio convention in Las Vegas, as I talked about, it was this people whispering about politics. What do you think about the war? What do you think about our president? I think the freedom to free speech and the good old rock and roll United States, I never remember 69, Woodstock and so on.
Yeah.
This contradiction between traditions and new breaking, don't forget it, because that's where we are equal.
Well, there was a period after 9/11 for almost, I'd say, a good solid two years. Where people were afraid to speak in public against the government, against the Bush administration. You've not been back to the United States for a couple of years. Let me tell you, that has changed. The comedians are now making fun of George Bush. There is a consensus. Republicans are coming out for Barack Obama and like this. We just have a half a minute left. Jesper Grunwald, your best advice for Americans about how to bring about change in our own country. Any thoughts on that?
In the States? Okay.
Yeah. How can we make the United States more egalitarian the way we
are? Don't forget Europe. Even if you are going to solve your own problems, and even if you are the main part of solving problems all over the world, don't forget the lines to Europe, where a lot of your people came from, and I think this soft connection between Europe and the United States is very, very important.
I agree.
We need you, and I think that you need us.
I agree. That's why I'm here. Thank you very much. Jesper Grunwald.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
This is Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program, live from Copenhagen, Denmark. And, well, let's see here. The Danes, the average work week is 37 hours, 6 weeks vacation a year mandated, state-paid paternity for 6 months to a year, state-paid education through college. You can take as long as you want to complete your degree, and you get paid to go to college. Security, essentially, from birth till death, financial, educational, social. The catch, of course, over 50% taxes, although if you're making very little, it's a little bit less than that. And if you're making a whole lot, it's a little more than that. But in any case, our next guest, Carl Christensen, wrote what started out as a sort of tongue-in-cheek piece for the Christmas edition of the British Medical Journal, and it was titled "Why Danes Are Smug: Comparative Study of Life Satisfaction in the European Union." Cor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And 60 Minutes. Now, you started this thing out as kind of a tongue-in-cheek piece, and it took off. It took off. In fact, 60 Minutes came over here a year ago. They did a special on you. And now you're in the position of saying, well, you know, and you're an epidemiologist, a professor of epidemiology at the Southern University of Denmark. And, in fact, you live and work in the hometown of Hans Christian Andersen.
Yeah.
And now you're in the position of saying, well, yeah, it was a joke, but it's really not a joke.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a good tradition that the British Medical Journal has. It's the British Medical Journal is one of these high-ranking, very serious medical journals.
Very pompous.
Yeah. And then once a year at Christmas, they allowed themselves to take in kind of, you know, like, is it really true that surgeons look better than other doctors kind of papers? Or is it really good wearing a parachute when you jump out airplanes? You know, is there any studies looking at this? And you know, trying to, what is the true psychiatric diagnosis for Gollum in the Lord of the Rings? You know, they have discussion about this. So we decided to make a piece on this fact that in nearly no matter how you summarize the data, the Danes come out as extreme outliers in these studies of life satisfaction, happiness.
Outliers meaning they're outside the norm.
Yeah.
They're way outside the norm.
They're kind of, you have all the curves of the different countries, and then above all of them, Denmark is there.
In terms of life satisfaction, happiness, quality of life, right across the board.
Yeah. So why is this? And because a lot of the Scandinavian countries has a lot of similarities and so on. And, you know, to tell you the truth, they actually come back to a discussion I have with my wife for 25 years, because I'm an born optimist. So I kind of say, you know, it's probably going to work and so on. So, and I always said, if you worry ahead of time, you get the worries two times, you know, ahead of time and once they appear. While he always claimed that if you're a little bit worried up front, you know, you're kind of vaccinated once the trouble came around. Because then you were prepared and you kept your expectation low. And we have kind of been discussing this for 25 years.
She's a scientist also.
She's also a medical doctor and a scientist. Yeah. So it's kind of. And then suddenly, I was glancing through what's called the Eurobarometer, which is the official EU statistics, and you know, they come out, I think, every half year or something. And I was looking, and yeah, Denmark was up there, very happy. And then I realized there was another set of questions about people's expectations.
Right.
And so I kind of say, okay, now actually, now we can settle our 25-year discussion. Uh-huh. Because, you know, I could go and look to see, was there any connection between your expectation and your life satisfaction? If my wife was right, those with low expectation would be happy because they were kind of didn't put too high expectation. But according to my view, you know, you should expect thing and be happy once they happen.
Sure.
And it turned out, unfortunately, that she was right.
Your wife was right. Okay.
So.
Well, this raises the question then: are we talking here about happiness or satisfaction? Because those are very different things, are they?
Yeah, they're related, though. They're related. And it's also, what we also then did was doing a lot of, you know, the word, what do you mean by satisfied? What do you mean? Is this different from country to country, the word you use for it? Does it have slightly different meanings and so on? And we also discussed, you know, these different aspects, but the findings are very robust, no matter how you kind of add this up.
The science is solid on this.
Yeah, it's kind of like, no matter who does this, you know, maybe not always Denmark is number one, but then they're always in the top group, you know, depending on. So we were pretty sure it was not because of this particular survey, because it kind of replicates. So at that point in time, we then just decided to make this tongue-in-cheek paper and then say, okay, how could we put a number of hypotheses? The first one was, it could be the old saying, blondes have more fun. You know, that might be.
But not everybody in Denmark is blonde.
Exactly.
not even the majority, it seems.
No. So what we could disprove it by showing that the Swedes were more blonde than the Danes. So
And they're not as happy.
No.
Okay.
So that was number one. Then we went on, is it the food, and you have been here for a couple of days, so you can verify it's not.
Yeah, and the food's kind of bland.
Yeah, and you know, at best unmemorable. You know, if you that is a high as it yet. The climate is, you know, usually pretty lousy.
Climate sucks.
Yeah, so it couldn't be that. And then we kind of course also went to the more serious one about the welfare system.
Right.
And there's this general feeling that, of course, people would complain about the high tax rates. But if they ask, do you want us to lower the service and you pay less tax? And the answer is immediately, no, no. You know, that's
right across the board.
That's far the majority. Of course, there's always people of a different opinion, but generally that's the feeling.
Right.
And there's this, of course, we have a gradient in, and we have also a socially disadvantaged group, but not on the range that is seen in many other countries. So there is a range, but it's kind of more compressed.
Are the extremes... One of the things that's notable about the United States right now and has been increasing dramatically since Ronald Reagan became president and radically changed our tax policies and our tax code is that we are now back where we were in 1929 in terms of extremes between wealth and poverty in the United States. We have... our millionaires have become multimillionaires. Our multimillionaires have become billionaires, and our poor people have become terribly impoverished. We actually have, I mean, from some studies, over 10 million Americans who literally do not know where their food will come from in the next 24 hours. Literally, I mean, we have millions of Americans who are going to bed hungry. This is unimaginable, not just in Denmark and not just in Scandinavia. I would say probably pretty much anywhere in certainly Western Europe and Northern Europe. Are the extremes of wealth and poverty in Denmark significantly different than the other Scandinavian countries or the other European countries that you were comparing? Is that one of the variables?
No. So that was why this also kind of couldn't explain it, because the Swedes have a system very... very similar to ours, and maybe even a little bit better in some aspects. So that's for sure not the explanation.
So what is the explanation?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. So what we then went to was, of course, the expectation thing.
Right.
But then the other thing, you know, because this was...
your wife's hypothesis.
Yeah, that was also, we could see a jump that the Danes got even more happy in the beginning of the 90s and, you know, made a further jump. And that was when we won the European Soccer Championship, you know.
So it's all about your sports team. Well, I can tell you there are sports fans all over America who have seen their teams go up or seen their teams go down in defeat who would probably agree with that hypothesis. but seriously, is
no,
that...
you know, I mean, it gave a certain... boost to the national, you know.
Yeah.
It's been downhill since 1066, you know, for about 1,000 years. We've been losing territory and getting smaller.
Since 1066, that was the Norman invasion of England.
Yeah. So the
Battle of Hastings.
Yeah. We have had...
That affected you here in Denmark?
Yeah, you know, and then at the Viking Age we were big, but also later on, you know, and we had Norway, Sweden, the West Indies, and big parts of Germany and so on. So we shrunk over the years and so on. But now, you know, what I thought was interesting was that what really caught on with this joke and what some of the news took as serious and others just as a joke was this about the expectation part.
Yeah.
But apparently a lot of countries related to it very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
It was so that the countries that were very unhappy on a European level, like Italy and Portugal, had very high expectations for the coming year. So these guys easily get disappointed.
So expectation. I'd like to, after the break, I'd like to ask you, how does having a strong social safety net play into expectations? And what are the cultural differences that might vary those things? And then we'll take calls from our listeners as well, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Core Christians.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is Tom Hartman.
Is it all about attitude? I don't know. Let's ask Carl Christensen, the author of the study. This is the guy who got the whole thing started here with some initial tongue-in-cheek thoughts that have turned into basically a whole school of science. Now, you're also a professor a researcher in aging.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I want to get into how to live a long and happy life with you as well. It's a good question. But just to wrap up our conversation from the last segment, and also toss it open to our callers, our listeners, 866-303-2270 if you have questions for Core Christensen. Expectations, you said, at a certain level, if people don't expect a lot, then they're not easily disappointed. Do I have that right?
Yeah. And first I have to say, I was not the guy getting this started. It has been around for a long time, and it is a very well-established field.
Yeah.
We just gave a slightly different angle on it just for fun, but then it you know, kind of caught really
sure.
on.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe also, I also talked to other foreign media about this, that like also now you're coming to Denmark because mm-hmm. we were number one and
right.
you want to learn why this is so.
Right.
I'm pretty sure if it was the opposite, that US was number one and Denmark was number two, the Danish television wouldn't go to US and say, you know, how do you do this and why are you the most happy? And so
oh, that's interesting.
I think they'll say, well, we're number 22. That's not too bad. You know, you're still in top 25, you know, why, you know, so, so if you kind of upfront expect to be number one, to be exceptional, you know, to be outstanding all the time in all aspects, you know, you're bound for disappointment.
But the part of the reason why Louise and I came to Denmark to do this show, why we wanted to do this show, was because in March we did a show, a live show by satellite phone from the border of Darfur in southern Sudan. And this was like being dropped into hell. I mean, you know, it was 130, 120 degrees plus Fahrenheit in the heat of the day at night. It might get down to 95. I can't translate that to Celsius quickly, but you get it.
Yeah,
it's pretty. And we were in a refugee community, Gök Macar. It used to be a town of 8,000 agriculturalists. Now it's 45,000 refugees, people coming in literally every day, arriving from Darfur, as which was just 15, 20 miles away, as their villages are being bombed, as their people are being murdered. People being released from slavery. It was hell on earth. It was the worst place on earth. And so I thought it would be an interesting bookend to check out the best place on earth. Right? but here's the point. I don't think that the expectations of the South Sudanese or the Darfurians are all that high, frankly. I mean, you know, if they can marry and have a couple of goats and have, you know, some children, life is good. It's not the go-go American culture that I experienced in that part of Sudan. And so it may well be that they have a level of expectation that's not that different than or ambition, let's say.
Yeah.
Now, I suspect there's a difference between ambition and expectation because you expect to be safe, and the Darfurians and the southern Sudanese don't expect to be safe. Is that a difference?
Yeah.
What am I missing here?
I think that these are so different worlds that any comparison in, you know, this way, saying, you know, comparing the problems of the Danes with this these people in Africa is not valid because they are in surviving mode and you know, so there's certain levels, and what we are discussing here is that, you know, in countries where you're not at war, where you have food, where you are, you know, having like Western world, that's where this discussion is appropriate. But it couldn't be extended to these extreme situation where you're considering survival of yourself and your kids and so.
Well,
so that's another world, as you said.
Abraham Maslow, you know, in his hierarchy of human needs, he talked about the foundational needs of safety and survival, of homeostasis and safety, as being things that would even prevent people from meeting their social needs if they were unmet. But once those foundational needs, those two at the bottom of the hierarchy, are established, then people start moving up through social needs and family needs and then into things like love and spirituality. What differentiates, ultimately at the end of the day, what differentiates the Danes from
from their peers in Scandinavia who have similar social welfare systems, similar economies, similar genetic and backgrounds, similar languages even and cultures.
Yeah, that's the key question, and I don't think that except from the there's a slightly more continental touch to Denmark than the rest of Scandinavian. Mm. Our Scandinavian brothers usually describe us as more enjoying life, but it also has a downside. We live shorter than they do. We are less well-behaved. Yeah. So there's a price to it, but that's usually what our Scandinavian brothers that we are better at partying, you know.
Yeah. There's a fairly high level of alcohol consumption and nicotine.
Absolutely, we really falling behind in terms of healthy lifestyles with alcohol and smoking.
So maybe you're happy because you drink so much and you smoke so many.
Doesn't really work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to ask you about Rolligans.
Yeah.
And how to live a long and healthy life, and then we'll take calls from our listeners 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Cor Christensen, is our guest, who is the professor, the author of the Happiness Study, as it's become known.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Frightened. We've been frightened by the Bushies into a war where people in America are afraid that if they get sick, they're going to end up bankrupt. They're going to end up homeless. I mean, this is a reality. 10 million Americans going to bed hungry or not knowing where the next meal is coming from. What's the difference? We have with us a professor of epidemiology, a physician, Cor Christensen, with the Southern University of Denmark. He's the author of the study that was published in the British Medical Journal about why Danes are smug, a comparative study of life satisfaction in the European Union. And you got your PhD, your MD, and other than your living expenses, your education was paid for by your country, right?
Yeah.
Might that be why you're happy?
Yeah, I came out of a non-academic family, So actually, the social mobility has a pretty good chance.
It's tremendous here, yeah, apparently. Let's take some phone calls. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And then after I'll fit my questions in between them, because I do want to get to Rolligans here. Jerry in Delray Beach, Florida, listening on WINZ. Hey, Jerry, you're on the air with Cor Christensen.
Hello. What in hard
it? Yeah, how'd it got? Tack?
God, you have I Denmark at all in 1970.
Okay.
And it was, what I just said is, how are you doing? And that I spent a year in Denmark in graduate school at the University of the Institute of Psychology in the city of Aarhus.
Uh-huh. Okay. Great.
And I had the most fabulous year, and I was actually doing some research in what you're discussing.
Okay.
At the time, I had been, I had studied, I got my bachelor's at Cornell, and I was doing research in something that was brand new in America, which was called cohabitation.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had just started having men and women officially living together unmarried. And I decided to replicate the study in Denmark, and it was quite interesting that it was not an anomaly there, but it was quite an ordinary occurrence.
Yeah.
So it seemed to me that there was not this strong morality in the country at that time that was very oppressive on people, and there wasn't a very strong religious, there was spirituality and religion, but somehow it didn't impose itself upon the people the way it sometimes does here in America, and certainly did 30 and 40 years ago.
Yeah. Jerry, you raise a great question. Thank you very much for the call. You know, Karl Marx called religion the opiate of the masses and suggested that people being kept in fear, that religion could be used to induce fear. Denmark is a relatively a-religious country. You're largely Lutheran, but the churches aren't full every Sunday.
Absolutely not.
Do you think that that has something to do with it? I suspect most Americans would say, yeah, religious people are happy people.
Yeah, and a lot of research from the U.S. suggests that. But it's also, it's true that the churches are empty, except for weddings, funerals, and baptism, and Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Then you fill them. But it's actually interesting. We have a state church here, and people argue a lot about whether that's appropriate or not. And actually, you pay about, I think it's about 1% of your income. I don't remember the exact number, but it's about 1%. And if you kind of say, I won't be a member of the state church, you'll save this 1% of your income. So it's, you know, it's not right. much, but at least something, you
sure.
know. And the funny thing is the majority of the population is still in the church and pay this 1%.
Because they feel like the institution,
It's part of your life. You don't use it so much, but it's there. It's a little bit like the state, I think. It's like a fallback thing.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the thing I noticed that might be one of the differences between our two countries is that there's generally a very high confidence in the state, you know.
Right.
It's annoying.
People trust the government here.
Yeah, or maybe not the government. It's more like, you know, if you really get into trouble, they'll help you.
Right.
And they won't cheat, you know. It's not like they'll do strange thing or, you know. While I often think that in America you meet the opinion that you should be suspicious about what is the state up to, why do they need this information, you know, that it's kind of like it's not on your side. Mm. While here it's kind of like annoying big brother, you know. You have to, you know, do all this stuff and pay all this money. But eventually, if needed, he'll help.
Right. Whereas in the United States, it's not just the federal government that people are concerned about. And now, you know, George Bush listening into our phone conversations. Certainly, they're probably listening to this one because it's an international call. Oh, my God, maybe we're terrorists. But also now we have corporations doing this. I mean, if I go to the doctor and I submit the bill to my insurance company then sends me a form that I have to fill out to prove that I actually was there and was it me, and then they don't pay it until I hassle them. And if it's a terrible sickness, they'll figure out some loophole in the policy, and this happens all the time to people, that they just get bounced out. What is the key to long life? This is the other area of research that you're very into. What are the things that cause people to live a long time?
Yeah, then you come to the wrong place here because we are not doing very well. Actually,
right.
We have nearly the same life expectancy as the U.S., despite that you have some groups who have a very high mortality and very low life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
So we are falling way behind similar groups in the U.S. And most of it, you know, is according to the death statistic and what people die from. A lot of it suggests that it is bad habits.
Lifestyle diseases.
Yeah.
Yeah. So bottom line, don't drink to excess. Don't smoke at all. One of the folks in our chat room said, smoke what? You know, it's... People can smoke pot here without fear of arrest if they only have a small amount.
Well, it's not legal, but it's
not enforced.
Not to any particular degree,
right.
Is my impression.
And prostitution, for all practical purposes, is legal here. There are places that advertise it.
Yeah, but
sign up in front.
I'm not sure that's good for longevity, though.
Right. Okay. So none of these are good habits. What are the good habits? Good food? Exercise?
No. Exercise, we're doing pretty well. Bicycling is a big deal here, you know, as you can see.
I noticed a third of your population gets to work on a bicycle, according to the official statistics.
Yeah, so on that we're doing pretty well. But I think to many, that was also one of the reasons why we call it, why Danes are smart, because it also has a downside.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit, we're kind of like a small, pretty, protected, coherent thing that also maybe tends to be a little too happy with ourselves. And, you know, one of the problems that I think we have struggle with is that we're not very good in receiving foreigners, especially if they're very different from our culture.
Yeah.
So we have a lot to learn there from your country.
This is the immigrant problem that we're having. Yeah, we're going to have, in fact, the editor of the newspaper who published the notorious cartoons on the program tomorrow, and we will be discussing that topic. Liana, I believe I'm pronouncing it right, in Los Osos, California. Liana, K-Y-N-S.
Hi,
Liana.
This is Liana. Yes.
Liana, you're on the air with Core Christensen.
I want to talk to Dr. Christensen about this book that I just finished reading called The Geography of Bliss, written by Eric Weiner, who's a correspondent with NPR, our national radio. And he called it One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World, and he didn't go to Denmark. But I came out with after reading the whole book and three European countries were the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Great Britain, is that every country he went to had a different reason for being happy and a different kind of cultural approach to happiness. And so that you really can't compare in a way, and not just because of poverty or wealth.
In other words, the word happiness has different meanings to different people.
Yes, and then what makes them happy.
Right.
It's different in different cultures.
Right.
Okay. And I kind of warm to that because I'm an anthropologist.
Liana, what do you think defines happiness in the United States as compared to what you've heard so far over the course of this week of what might be defining happiness here in Denmark?
Well, the interesting thing is he came home and he said happiness was home, even though he wasn't too happy with his home. He was a perfect example of an American who went all over the world looking for something that would teach him how to be happy.
Right.
As Cor said, perhaps Americans are searchers and seekers.
Interesting. Yeah, it does seem to be in our cultural DNA. Linnea, thank you very much for the call. Cor, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think there's a big truth to this, that it's very hard to generalize this, but but still overall there's some patterns that people tend to, you know, be at a certain level of satisfaction with the condition under which they're living. And at least here in Europe, one of the differences that, for instance, with the government system in Southern Europe, like if you go to Italy, there's a big degree of mistrust to the system and how it works and so on.
Well, we've got Berlusconi. They've got essentially a crook running their country. But he also owns the biggest newspaper and radio networks in the country. So.
Yeah. So there's quite a range of systems working.
Yeah. Well, that's more laissez-faire. I mean, Italy is a more laissez-faire capitalist society. This is, I know you don't like to use the word socialist here, but this is you know, the commons is more collectively owned.
Yeah, there's a sense of coherence, and that you can, you know, trust people generally. The coherence, I think, gives people a certain security.
Yeah. Which brings us to Rolligans, and I'm going to ask you about that right after this break, and we'll pick up some more calls at 866-303-2270. We're talking with Cor Christensen. He is a professor of epidemiology at the Southern University of Denmark, a physician, and the author of the study that got this whole thing started, at least the conversation in the United States, on 60 Minutes. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
Time and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. A woman and the kids and the dogs and me.
Is that all it takes to be happy? The woman and the kids and the dogs and me. We're here with Cor Christensen. He is the professor of epidemiology, Southern University of Denmark, who is the author of the study Why Danes Are Smug, the Comparative Study of Life Satisfaction in the European Union. that made 60 Minutes and a whole bunch of other programs. And Cor, first let's take a couple of phone calls here, and then I want to get into Roligans. Mary in Seattle, you had a question for Dr. Christensen.
Did you say Mary?
Mary, you're on
the
air.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, we're talking about the level of satisfaction in people's lives, right? And I was wondering, what in Denmark is done for the mentally ill? I mean, here it's like either a revolving door. If you're lucky, you keep going in and out during crisis, or you're on the streets homeless, or it just seems like I've never met anyone with schizophrenia or bipolar or whatever that actually had a level of satisfaction in their life. And I was wondering, is something done better there?
Excellent question, Mary. Thank you. And also, in the United States, many of our health insurance programs do not cover mental illness. In fact, they're trying legislatively to force them to.
Yeah.
So how is mental illness treated here?
Well, I don't think we stick out very much in terms of how to treat it, and I think it's...
Relative to Europe.
Relative to Europe, yeah. So actually, on the contrary, some years ago, there was this big movement to kind of do the treatment at home and so on, which I think the idea and the ambition was very, very much appreciated.
Is that the deinstitutionalization movement?
Exactly.
Because we've seen that in the United States.
Yeah. And logistically, that just seemed like a very difficult thing to come through successfully.
Yeah.
So it is an area that got a lot of attention, and there's a lot of research in it, and so.
But a person with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or a truly disabling mental illness in Denmark, all of their medical expenses are covered.
Yeah.
There is a social safety net to provide them with housing and shelter if they can't work. Yeah. They're not going to live on the streets unless they choose to.
Unless they choose to.
Yeah, okay. Which you know, arguably may not be a rational choice, but nonetheless, we. Jamie in Seattle. Hey, Jamie, you're on the air with Cor Christensen, Dr. Christensen.
Hi, gentlemen. I'm curious about birth in Denmark and the use of midwives and home birth, and also if homeopathy is used very widely and alternative medicine.
Great questions. Thank you.
Well, we have a little bit of home birth and so on. And personally, I'm born at home, but I'm also so old. I'm about 50 years, so.
You're old man, you.
So, but today it's rare. Most people prefer to give birth in. Most women prefer to give birth in hospital, but we'll go home quickly afterwards. Mm. And in terms of alternative medicine, there's quite a lot around. It's not supported by the government by any means, because you have to, they're not too convinced about the evidence for this. And
if you want to see a homeopath or an herbalist, you do so on your own nickel. Your own kroner.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, interesting. What's a Roligan?
A Roligan is a well-behaved hooligan.
You have well-behaved hooligans here in Denmark.
Yeah, so it's kind of, it's a twist with the word, because Roli means kind of like quiet, nice behavior, but still having a good time. And it was actually something that came around when this glory period of Danish soccer in the 80s and early 90s, where it has been a disaster since. But, in this period, it was kind of like a whole new set of spectators, like families and all.
Right.
And they just dressed like in carnival and were really well behaved. And the big soccer tournaments really loved them, because they were used to the hooligans. And
the British tear down the stadium, yeah.
And suddenly, kind of like a family trip kind of entered the stadium. So that was a good kind of ambassadors from.
Fascinating. Mary in Bellevue, Washington, you're on with Dr. Cor Christensen.
Hi, gentlemen. Good morning. I wanted to reflect something from my own life. I am a 47-year-old lesbian. I grew up in Idaho, which is a scary place for gay people to be, and moved to the Seattle area specifically because I didn't feel safe in my home. And my level of happiness, I guess obviously, is way, way up, because I'm protected here by laws. My partner has a job where she covers me on my insurance, or on medical insurance. Excuse me. And that makes me feel safer. I'm self-employed. I don't think I'd do that if I weren't covered by my partner. And I really believe strongly in Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I didn't feel safe. So it didn't matter that I had a good job, a nice house, and actually was with a woman in Idaho. We had to hide. We had to play safe. And so that's just my request.
Point,
I'll go
Mara.
Ahead and get off the line and let you guys answer me.
Oh,
thank
okay,
you.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, we just have a minute before this hour is up. First of all, the status of gays and lesbians in Denmark.
Well, I think that, again, it's not sticking out in Europe. You know, there's been a transition from the old days where it was kind of hidden, and except maybe.
But gay partnerships have been legal here since 89, I believe.
Yeah, that's true. So,
England now has ratified gay marriage. It's kind of spreading across the continent.
Yeah.
Spain just did, I believe.
Yeah.
So there's a level of safety there associated with that. That's a good thing. I have a couple more calls, but we're just plain old flat out of time. We just have a few seconds. The tyranny of choice. I just wanted to raise this issue. Robert Wolf, a sociologist in the United States, a fascinating fellow, suggested to me that the more choices people have, the less happy they are. Do you think that because, you know, you don't have to decide which of 30 different medical plans you're going to choose, that might make people happier here?
Yeah. On the medical side, I think it's a real good thing, but it's also good to have some choices. So it's something about the balance. So maybe one of the reasons why we have is that we're kind of boring on the middle of the road, and you know
that's an okay place to be.
Yeah, you know.
Okay. Dr. Cork Christensen,
yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
You're
great,
welcome.
Great talking to you. Coming up next, Terry Jeffrey. CNS News Desk.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
This is Tom Hartman.
Well, 6 minutes past the hour of 11 on the West Coast and 2 in the afternoon on the East Coast of 8 p.m. here in Copenhagen, Denmark. Welcome back to our program. And Terry Jeffrey is on the line with us, the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. And Terry, hey, welcome.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good, good. I'm here in Denmark, Terry, and all week I've been talking to, we had a member of parliament on yesterday. We've talked to politicians, we've talked to scientists, we've talked to social scientists. A special tip of the hat to Leah Hjord, who's helping produce our program and doing a marvelous job here on this end, along with Sean Taylor back in Portland, the two of them working together and putting this together. And Leah has bringing in some guests. And everywhere I go, I find people who like the fact that they have free public education right up through PhD or MD, who like the, in fact, you get paid to go to college. No matter how long it takes you to graduate, that they like the fact that they have free health care, mental health, physical health, no matter what, it's totally free. They're not even deductibles. They like the fact that you get state-paid paternity leave, fathers, 6 months, paid salary, mothers, a year. They like the fact that if you get old, you have retirement homes that are very high quality, totally free. Hospice for people at end of life, totally free. Even the conservatives, who are now the governing party, by the way, the majority is the conservative party. It's called the liberal party here, but it's that's what means conservative in Europe. There, I can't find anybody in this country who says they want to do away with this. What am I missing?
Well, I'm happy for them. I'm glad they like their system. They have a right to choose it. They're a free country, but I doubt that people are as free in a place where they're that dependent on the government as they are in the United States of America, where most people still take care of themselves for most of their lives. And I'm glad that in this country we've been able to maintain some independence from our government, although I believe we have programs that are increasingly are making people here more dependent on their government. I don't think that's a good thing.
So, and I guess it's a matter of, you know, where do we draw the lines? Because I'm guessing that you and I both think that it's a good thing that we're dependent upon our government to run red and green streetlights.
Sure.
Okay. And we both think that it's a good thing that we're dependent upon our government to make sure that the police show up if we dial 911.
Absolutely.
Okay, we both agree that we're dependent on our, that it's a good thing that we're dependent on our government, that the fire department shows up if we dial 911.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing.
So what's wrong with having our health care paired?
Well, I would draw the line at health care, because at health care you get to profound moral questions that involve matters of life and death, what happens at the beginning of life and what happens at the end of life. And I think when you surrender those decisions to the government, and you also surrender them to questions of economic utility rather than doing what you think is right, you get into problems as a society. And I think the respect we have for the right to life in the United States, while not as great as it ought to be, is greater than in those societies where they have socialized medicine.
Well, they have a lower abortion rate here than we do in the United States.
They have fewer abortions or a lower abortion rate?
Fewer abortions per capita.
Mm-hmm. And do they have legalized euthanasia?
No, they don't.
They don't kill people at the end of life?
No.
That's illegal?
I believe that the only country in the world right now that has legalized euthanasia, and I'm not even sure they still do, is Holland. And mm-hmm. that was a huge debate about 5 years ago. I mean, you know, we have in Oregon, in the United States, if you can get two doctors to sign off that you have less than 6 months to live and you are in great pain, they will give you an overdose of barbiturates, which you can self-administer.
And we did starve Terry Schiavo to death.
To the extent that she was still Terry Schiavo.
Well,
yeah. So here it sounds to me like what you're saying is that the government is more intrusive in our lives in the United States than the Danish.
Well, look, I have to admit I'm not extremely familiar with the Danish system, but
I think
our government is too much involved in our lives. I don't want our government more involved in health care. I think that is a place that people ought to have autonomy. And also, if you have a system where the government, it basically creates a social welfare state, Tom, such as the one you've described in Denmark, that is going to, it must cause the attenuation of private philanthropy and private charity.
Well, you don't have as many billionaires to be passing out money, but they, you know, the arts are well funded. I mean, there's not the need for private philanthropy. But speaking of, by the way,
so that's not a good thing, though, Tom. And I don't think you need billionaires.
It's not a good thing.
No, I don't.
You think it's a good thing that there be people who are in such extreme poverty that they have to depend on the droppings from the table of the rich?
For example, my late father was a Catholic physician. He was worked at a Catholic hospital in the city of San Francisco, which was essentially a charitable institution. They would treat people for free. They would also take payment from people, but they also took contributions from people to support themselves and charge people to support themselves. I think a Catholic hospital, for example, is an excellent example of a charitable institution that I would not want to see disappear from the landscape in the United States.
But they're the outliers. They're not the norm. I mean, the norm in the United States is either that you have a state or county run hospital, which are going away very fast, or you have, you know, the way that Bill Frist's father became a billionaire was when they changed the laws so that these county hospitals could be privatized. He bought them up and then, you know, started jacking down the prices, down the wages and jacking up the costs.
Well, you know, Tom, you and I might agree on this for-profit hospital phenomenon, especially when you have, like the one you described, I think it was HCA. That's the name of the corporation.
Yeah, it's Bill Frist's daddy's company.
Where you have
that made him like one of the 10 wealthiest men in America.
And Senator Frist himself had a huge chunk of stock in that, even though it was in a blind trust. When you have a for-profit hospital organization like that that's doing business with the government, as they do through Medicare, and they receive a lot of money through Medicare, what you have there basically is a corporate government alliance through socialism. Mm. Now, I think that is a worse model than where you have local public hospitals controlled by local people that are, in fact, charitable institutions, or like the hospital my father worked at, a Catholic hospital, which is a charitable institution. Yeah. I think that's a superior model.
Yeah. Interesting. We're talking with Terry Jeffrey. He is the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. Terry, aren't you happy that Senators Feingold and Dodd are working so hard to protect your privacy and mine? Speaking of intrusive government, I don't want the government spying on my phone calls, frankly. Not that I have anything in particular to hide, but it just creeps me out.
Well, I think any time any agency of government is going to intercept a phone call between people within the United States, they better go to a court and they better establish probable cause that a crime is being committed, and they better get a warrant before they do it. But when you're
so you oppose John McCain and most of the Republican Party on this.
Well, now, wait a minute. There's a distinction here. The sorts of communications that were being intercepted without warrant, according to General Hayden, and I do believe him, all were...
You believe a government bureaucrat?
I believe General Hayden. He has testified to this. I do believe him on this, and no one has proved this wrong.
This is the guy, you'll remember, Terry, who didn't understand the Fourth Amendment.
Well, I think he does. And if the facts as he presented them have proved wrong, then we'll revisit it. But what we know from what has been reported is the communications that were intercepted were international communications. At least one leg of the communication was outside the United States. There was reason to believe that someone involved in the communication was linked to Al-Qaeda. And these were not intercepted for law enforcement purposes. They were intercepted for national security purposes. They were, in fact, counter-espionage measures. And throughout the entire history of the United States, intelligence gathering of that kind has been the province of the executive branch under its duty to defend the United States against foreign attack. And that, and up until now, every appeals court that looked at it agreed with that. All prior presidents did unwarranted intercepts for national security. And I do believe that is acceptable. If they turned around and tried to do that within the United States, it'd violate the Fourth Amendment.
And when General Hayden was being questioned about this before Congress, he said that the key operational word in the Fourth Amendment was unreasonable, that you couldn't have unreasonable searches and seizures.
Right.
And one of the senators said to him, I forget which one it was, said, no, wait a minute, the Fourth Amendment says that you can't have an unreasonable search and seizure and you can't have any warrants for search or seizure issued but upon probable cause,
right,
supported by oath or affirmation. And he said, no, it has nothing to do with probable cause. It has to do with unreasonable.
Right.
He didn't understand the Fourth Amendment.
No, well, I think you're right. I think he may not understand the Fourth Amendment. I think what's wrong there may be General Hayden's constitutional exegesis rather than his understanding what ought to and can be done for the security of the United States.
But now they're, like, snatching laptops when you come back. I mean, when I fly back into the United States, they can take my laptop now without a warrant. And they're doing it, by the way.
Well, if you're a U.S. citizen and you're standing in Kennedy Airport and they search your laptop without a warrant, I don't think they can do that.
They have been for years now.
They may have reason to
detain. In fact, they're taking them for as much as a year away from people. Terry, you want to stick around? We'll continue the conversation. Okay, we're talking with Terry Jeffries, CNSNews.com. While we're on the break, Terry, you may want to Google this, because this is, I'm telling you, this is real. The Customs Service has been taking people's laptops, and in some cases they don't get them back for as much as a year, just because they're entering the country. Anyhow, it's a Tom Hartman program, 866-303-2270. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman program, where smart people get their news.
Terry Jeffrey on the line with us, the editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com, defending the right today, and I'm defending the left. Is it reasonable to call it that, Terry?
Sure.
Okay. Did you try? It's right up at the top of Think Progress, in fact, .org, if you want to see the most recent debate on this thing. This whole issue of the Customs and Border Patrol searching laptops. And now we've got, you know, other governments, oppressive governments, saying, well, you know, Bush listens in on phone conversations. He takes people's laptops. We can do that.
Well, okay. This is something I'd have to study. But if you're talking about something that's coming across the international border into the United States, you're talking about something that's subject to the customs laws of the United States and is subject to security considerations in terms of defending ourselves against a terrorist attack. I think that's a little different than someone coming into your house or stopping you in a domestic airport where you haven't been coming in from overseas and seizing your laptop.
I agree, but shouldn't the Customs Service still, if they want to, I think it's perfectly appropriate that they ask me to open my suitcase. I have no problem with that. You know, I've traveled in and out of Israel a lot, and other countries, frankly, where there's very, very intense security. And, you know, they go through everything. One time, you know, because I had a Saudi Arabian Airlines sticker on my bag, they actually took the toothpaste out of my toothpaste tube. I mean, you know, I've been through security, right? But there's a difference between looking at your papers and looking at what you have and asking somebody for their passwords and encryption and everything else so that they can go through years of records that may be on your computer.
And they were doing this to U.S. nationals?
That's right. Anybody that they damn well please. The Customs and Border Patrol has taken the position they can take anybody's laptop, period.
And
it's a routine part of border searches. This
without
is routine,
doing
according to that.
Serious study of it, I would say if they're taking a U.S. citizen's laptop computer at the border and they want to search all the contents of that computer, it would seem to me reasonable on the face of it that they could hold the computer, see if they could get a warrant, and then look at it. Now,
see,
I think a foreign national is a different situation.
Yeah, but in April, a federal appeals court held that they could seize your computer, they could copy the entire contents. This would be routine. They do not need probable cause. They don't even need the lower standard of reasonable suspicion. They can simply do it just for the hell of it.
Well, I'd have to see the argument behind it, but I do think it's a unique circumstance with someone entering the United States from overseas that's a little bit different than going into someone's home or seizing their computer from their office. So I'd want to think that through and see what the arguments are before I had a final judgment on it.
Okay. You wrote an op-ed recently over at CNSNews.com, Terry Jeffrey, suggesting that by the state or local municipalities or federal government helping to fund early education, early childhood education, or daycare, that we are essentially becoming that the government is essentially anti-family.
Right. I think, well, first of all, both Senator Clinton and Barack Obama, as I understand it, advocated universal preschool, and Senator Obama has a program he calls 0 to 5 where he wants kids basically in government programs from the moment they're born. His argument...
If their parents want them there.
Yeah, he's not mandatory. There's no doubt. He wants it to extend to every child, but he's not talking about mandating it. Yeah, I do think it's a bad thing. I was looking at Department of Labor Statistics. They do excellent work, by the way, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in profiling the U.S. workforce. And since 1948, 17% of married mothers in America went to work. As of 1997, 70% of married mothers go to work. But even more disturbing from my conservative point of view is that a majority of married mothers with infants, that's babies under 1 year old, are now in the workforce in the United States. They're not staying home with newborn babies.
Oh, that's terrible. What we need in the United States is what they have in Denmark, which is 1 year paid maternity leave.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Tom, that the
I'm quite serious.
Labor Department data, it's very interesting. It's the poorest, and we're talking about women who are married and their husbands work. We're not talking about women who have to work because they're divorced or their husband's dead or whatever. The poorest women who are married and their husbands work, and the richest women whose husbands work, they stay home. They tend to stay home. A majority stay home. It's the middle class women who are going out to work when their babies are less than a year old.
Well, the reason for that is that the poorest can't afford daycare, and the oldest don't need to work.
Well, the richest
don't need to work.
Maybe that's part of the explanation, but there's other data that points at some other things. For instance, immigrant married women tend to stay home with their babies, and American-born married women tend not to stay home with their babies, and women who have more babies tend to stay home, and women who have only one baby tend to leave their infant at home. And I would argue that that data points to a cultural divide where there are culturally more conservative families who think it's really important to stay home with the young child and less culturally conservative families who think it's better for mom to go to work and leave the baby with someone else. And my argument would be government programs that provide subsidies and pay taxes money to support programs that those who choose to leave their young children in someone else's care are a disproportionate, basically it's a transfer of wealth from traditional families to non-traditional families.
Yeah, and I don't totally disagree with you. What I would say, though, is that 1 year of paid maternity leave and a half year of paid paternity leave sounds like a good halfway solution to this thing.
But Tom, here's a question of justice for that. Let's say you're a small business person. You've built up a business. You've been good to your employees. You have like 25 employees, and some people are really working hard, and then one woman goes and she gets a year off paid leave while the other is still in for her position, and they're paying to cover that. Is that really fair?
No, it's not. It's a tough. It would be a tough one for small businesses, and you know, we'd have to figure out how to get around that. I, you know, a couple of solutions come to mind, but we're out of time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Terry Jeffrey, CNSNews.com. Your
call. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Today, John Roberts, Justice John Roberts, did what he did so well for about $2 million a year for so many years as a corporate attorney. He stood up for the big guy. Yep. Exxon Valdez oil spill, $2.5 billion in punitive damages, which is about what ExxonMobil makes every 2.5 days. Yeah, ExxonMobil. Profits. We're talking profits, not revenues. Profits! About $1 billion a day. So, you know, the original ruling was, hey, you know, the world's worst oil spill, almost as bad as all the oil spills that happened as a result of Hurricane Katrina. Yes, by the way, John McCain doesn't know about it, but there were a bunch of them, and the coast was devastated by those oil spills, the Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama coast. But nonetheless, the worst shipping disaster as a result of negligence. Let's slap this company with a 2.5 day penalty. 2.5 days of income. And John Roberts and Scalia and Thomas, who votes however Scalia, they should just change Thomas's name to Scalia Thomas, and Kennedy and Souter all said, you know, 2.5 days of income, that's too much of a penalty for fouling the environment. We're going to cut it down to a half day's income. $500 million. What? Why is the Supreme Court determining the amount of money that should be paid in a judgment? I don't get it. This has nothing to do with what's constitutional or not. The Constitution doesn't say there shall be a limit on torts or there shall be no limit. This is outrageous. So anyhow, number one. Number one thing that seems to be going on. The other is that I'm not sure if it's as at this moment as we speak, but a little earlier, Senator Feingold was on the floor of the Senate speaking about this god-awful FISA bill. And we're now having, you know, there's a few other folks coming out and speaking out against it. Among them, apparently Schumer. Harry Reid has said he doesn't like it. We'll see. I think maybe the tide will turn. If enough senators hear from enough of us, you can go to callcongress.org and get the phone numbers. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And John in Palo Alto, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I wanted to respond to Jeffries and the cultural argument that he was making.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's one that's easily seen if you were to take a U.S. citizen who becomes an immigrant to India or China, where India and China are adopting Western lifestyles, that you would have the wife, the American wife, staying at home, not working because of cultural differences. They couldn't acclimate to the Indian version of our lifestyle or the Chinese version of our lifestyle, whereas the male would be forced to.
Okay. Okay. Well, it's an interesting point. John, thank you. I'm not sure exactly how it ties in, but okay. Justin in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, Justin.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
I just want to make a comment about the last guest you had on when he was saying that women who send their kids to daycare are like somehow destroying the American family or something like that. You know, in my personal case, we're middle class. My wife's educated. I'm educated. And, you know, when we had our son about 4 years ago, she was out. She was on maternity leave. The state, I think, gave on the disability 2/3 of her pay for, I think it was 8 weeks. The company she works for, being as she's educated and a good employee, was kind enough to give her 8 more weeks. However, we had to send them to daycare, which cost quite a bit of money out of our pocket every month, just for the simple fact that we could not afford to sustain an average middle-income lifestyle if we didn't, because without her working.
But Justin, you had the choice. You could move into a trailer, or you could move into a, you know, you could live in your SUV or something.
I certainly could.
You realize I'm being facetious. Actually, I think that there is an issue here that we need to address, and this is the larger issue, and that is that is the question of how, as a society, as a culture, are we going to be raising our kids? And
yeah.
I think that we can all agree, probably, that having children raised in a nurturing, loving environment is a really important thing, and that
Absolutely.
A lot of daycare in the United States doesn't qualify as that. And
it doesn't.
I'm speaking as a parent who has of three children who all at various times in greater or lesser degrees were in daycare. Louise and I owned a business in the early 80s, the travel company, International Wholesale Travel in Atlanta, where we actually had a daycare center for a while on site. We actually provided daycare to our employees, and we were very careful to make sure that it was not just, hey, let's get the minimum wage person down the street.
I'm in the same boat. I'm very
right.
cool. You know, we searched high and low, and I'm paying $800 a month to have them go to a place that we were comfortable with. Again, the person I have my son with, you know, she's been in business a long time, and like I said, it's $800 a month, and we searched high and low, and I trust her with my child, and a lot of people cannot afford that. However,
exactly, and that's the thing. Here in Denmark, in order to be providing daycare to children, you have to be basically as educated and licensed as a person who is a teacher in a public school. In other words, it's a high status job.
The lady who takes care of my son, she ran a school for 25 years, and we were lucky to actually get in when we did. And again, though, I think the point he was trying to make is flies in the face of just simple reality and the fact that there's no way I could, you know, I live in a modest house, a 1,500 foot house here in Southern California. It's nothing fancy. It's a nice place, but I mean, it's not a mansion. And we are solid middle income earners. But without her income, being as she's educated and has a very, very good job, which pays benefits, you know, health, dental, things like that.
Right.
I'm self-employed, so I can't really afford that for myself. She pays all those pennies. And, you know, it flies in the face of reality that saying, oh, well, the mom has to stay home with the child. And, I mean, I agree that would be the ideal situation. And there's nothing more I would like than to have my son be home with my wife since he was born until she's comfortable sending him to a school.
Or home with you. But, you know, if we're talking about, there's really on the right, I don't want to try and characterize Terry's perspective on this because I don't know it in detail enough too, and besides that, you know, I'm not him and he's not here to defend himself. But on the right, there are two arguments that are made, and I think both of them can be knocked down. One is that it's basically an extension of the mindset of keep women barefoot, pregnant, and at home. That women are the property of their husbands, and therefore, and that their only purpose is to breed babies.
That's ridiculous, as we know.
Well, it's ridiculous, but it's a point of view that's held by a lot of people in the United States and in many quote traditional end quote cultures around the world where women are literally the property of their husbands. That's number one. The second one is that our traditional culture. And this is the language that they'll use. They'll say, traditionally, what we've done is mom and dad have raised the kids. Actually, traditionally, if you go back more than 200 years or so, and you look at the last couple thousand years, and certainly if you look in Aboriginal and Indigenous societies, traditionally for 100,000 years, it's been mostly the grandparents who raise kids, because the parents were of the age and of the physical capability that they could go out and gather food and hunt and gather and bring in the food.
And so what we're reinventing, and what Denmark, I think, has done a very good job of reinventing here, and what America is doing a poor job of, because we're trying to do it, you know, in the for-profit model, is reinventing that extended family, that Hillary Clinton, it takes a family to raise a child. Justin, I've got to move along, but thank you for the call, and your points, I think, are very well made. Kathy in Los Angeles. Hey, Kathy.
Hi, Tom. I'm a working mother, and I'd like to speak as a woman on this issue because I keep hearing the men speak for me.
Thank you.
I'm afraid that there is no good way to be a woman in America today. Your guest was saying that it was these middle-class women who did this, and the fact is, yes, it is, because if I didn't work, we wouldn't be middle-class at all.
Right.
And I don't mean solidly middle-class. I mean barely hanging on middle-class. I actually out-earn my husband. And people act like that's not even a possibility. And, Tom, that's sexist, to act like it's not even possible that I could be more successful than he is. And I went back to work after 3 weeks after my daughter was born.
Mm-hmm.
And she came to work with me and was at the infant care center at my work.
That's great.
But, no, it's not ideal. But I don't know why the ideal has to be a mom and not a dad. I don't know why the ideal has to be...
Or grandparents or aunts and uncles or somebody in the community or even outside the community, somebody who has the training and the temperament to provide really high quality health daycare that is nurturing, supportive, and educational. Why can't we have that in the United States?
I don't know. I don't know why we can't have any of it, that there can't be some level of choice in the matter. And this is what feminists keep wanting, and everybody keeps wanting us to have something else.
Well, I would submit to you that we don't have it because it's not in the interest of big multinational corporations and very wealthy people.
And I hate when they use the small business thing, because then it's like, oh, all these hardworking people, and you're going to be lazy and stay at home. And it's like, well, we can't win. If we work, we're being selfish. And if we stay at home, we're being selfish.
Excellent point. Kathy, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you, Tom. Love the show.
Thank you. Appreciate hearing from you. It is a conundrum, and it's a conundrum that here in Denmark they face, and they've said, you know, we're going to provide high-quality daycare to children and parents. It's easy. This is not rocket science. 45 minutes past.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
With the newspaper publisher who didn't just publish the Mohammed cartoons. He actually went out and commissioned them, went out and looked for somebody to come up with them. This is an agent provocateur. It should be a very, very interesting conversation. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, by the way, brought to you in part by the Teamsters fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more at teamster.org. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Victoria, what's happening today in the world?
Well, Tom, a number of things. First of all, a question. What happens to you if you belong to Planned Parenthood, or if you used to work for John Kerry's presidential campaign, or if you're pro-Wolf, or if you used to work for Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton? Well, of course, as you probably know, the answer is you don't get to get into the honors and summer intern program at the Justice Department.
Now,
you didn't used to.
Yeah, and it may still be that you can. This is absolutely bizarre. The Justice Department has this program for interns. It is not supposed to be influenced by politics. The Justice Department is about upholding the law. It's not about promoting a political party. But if you happen to work for the Peace Corps or you were a member of Greenpeace, no, you can't get in. But if you're a member of the Federalist Society, no problem. The right-wing judicial bunch, then you get in. This is bizarre.
It is quite extraordinary.
It seems to me like this is right on the edge of is it the Smith Act or the Hatch Act? I mix them up. But the one that says that you can't use government buildings for political purposes, it's a felony, or government facilities. This is dancing right around the edge of that, is it not?
Yes, it is dancing right around the edge of that, and I think it's the Hatch Act. Now, I haven't heard that mentioned in connection with this. All that seems to be mentioned in connection with this, and the Department of Justice's investigative arm has done a report that's just come out on this, really is to say how appalling it is. The people who seem to have been involved in enforcing this extremely dubious practice no longer work at the Department of Justice, so basically nobody's going to be punished, and of course Alberto Gonzalez is no longer there.
Yeah, I think this goes beyond appalling. I do think that this is a violation of the Hatch Act. And if not, there should be an investigation. I mean, you know, if they can look into whether Bill Clinton lost $30,000 in a land deal 32 years before he became president, if they can look into whether or not Hillary Clinton fired a travel agent because she didn't like the person's personality, if they can have, a million-dollar federal investigation of the Christmas cards the White House is sending out during the Clinton administration, then they certainly can look into whether or not bringing people into the intern program at the Department of Justice is based on political criteria, that being a government facility and government agency, is a violation of the Hatch Act.
Well, they are going to be continuing in their investigations. They're going to look at other accusations of politicization in the Justice Department. And, of course, they are going to be looking at why the U.S. attorneys were dismissed in late 2006. Yeah. They're investigating that. And so the Justice Department is not out from under its cloud. But what you're suggesting, I think we're going to hear more about that as more of these reports come out. And I think what we will find is more shenanigans, more dubious doings. I think that the drumbeat will get louder and louder, and Congress is going to be forced to take action.
I from your lips to God's ears, Victoria, I sure hope so. And if not in this legislative session, then in the next one. It is so important that all these violations of law, from Karl Rove using the Justice Department to prosecute Don Siegelman, and let me again encourage my listeners to go to Don Siegelman, I-before-E, donsiegelman.org, and donate some money to his efforts. He's fighting the good fight, and he's the guy, I think, frankly, that'll get Karl Rove put in jail. And, whether it's that or whether it's what you just described here, I mean, it's like every day a new outrage comes out. Henry Waxman, the mustache of justice, as Christy Harvey calls him, he's got to have so many balls in the air, plates spinning around or whatever the, cliched metaphor is. He can't keep them straight. I mean, there's so many crimes that have been committed by this administration.
I don't know how he copes with this job. Now, the Attorney General, Mr. Mukasey, he apparently says that using politics in hiring career lawyers is impermissible and unacceptable. He says the department has taken steps to fix the problem. Dana Perino today addressed this issue. I asked her specifically about this issue, and she said that Mukasey has put these steps in place. I also asked her, by the way, whether the president was surprised by this report. And she said she was actually surprised by my question and said that she hadn't asked him whether he was surprised.
That's interesting. Well, it wouldn't surprise me if this is stuff that just came down from Karl Rove from the get-go. This is just classic Bush administration stuff. Amazing. So I've shared with our listeners a few minutes ago about the Supreme Court Exxon Valdez, now John Roberts doing what he does so well, protect big corporations. This whole death penalty for child rapists, which actually, one of the arguments that they made was that if the death penalty was there, it may encourage more people to murder children, which I think actually makes a certain amount of sense. But other Supreme Court, isn't the gun decision coming down tomorrow?
Those of us who live in Washington, D.C. are anxiously awaiting that decision. We're expecting it to come down tomorrow. We were actually expecting it to come down today, but I think they did the child rape decision today, and apparently they're only capable of one big decision per day, so they like to keep us in waiting for another big decision.
Wasn't Exxon Valdez tomorrow today, too?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't the Exxon Valdez one today,
yes,
too?
Yes, Exxon Valdez was also.
So they can do two.
Right. They can do two.
They can chew gum and hum, but they probably can't walk.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, you're right.
Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you.
Great talking with you today. And coming up tomorrow,
It's going to be a fascinating. We're going to have, as I mentioned, we're going to have the publisher who published the what's referred to as the Muhammad cartoons. It should be a fascinating time. And our old friend Yarn Brook is going to drop by and tell us why capitalism is superior to democracy. Don't forget, my friends, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. Call your senator now about FISA. We'll see you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.